Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the Iowa Caucus's podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on February the 2nd, 2016. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And Frank, this week on TWiL, we're pleased to welcome Devin McGraw. Ms. McGraw is Deputy Director for Health Information Privacy at HHS's Office for Civil Rights. She's having an illustrious career in health law and policy, working as the Director of the Health Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. She was COO at the National Partnership for Women and Families, and most recently co-chaired the Privacy and Data Security Practices at Manapp, Phelps, and Phillips. Welcome, Devin.
Thank you very much, Nick. Glad to be here.
Well, first a lightning round where Frank and I get rid of the legal detritus that has fallen on our desks over the last 7 days. I'll start and I'll see just how many listeners I can chase away by starting with a case that combines oddball state policy with arcane federal constitutional law. Virginia is one of 36 states that still requires providers to obtain a certificate of need to establish or expand healthcare services law. Well, Colon Health Centers of America against Hazel is a 2016 case, just came down a couple of days ago from the Fourth Circuit. It's just one sliver of some long-standing litigation. This particular episode invoked the Dormant or Reverse Commerce Clause, as Colon Health Centers argued that the state's denial of a certificate of need to them discriminated against interstate commerce. The Fourth Circuit here upheld the state's summary judgment, and indeed the court seemed satisfied that the purpose of the Virginia CON process was less about discouraging out-of-state competitors to the benefit of incumbents, and more about preventing overinvestment in underutilized facilities or the maldistribution of healthcare facilities that, in their opinion, can exacerbate access problems. I don't know about you, Frank, but the merits of this particular case aside, I do find it remarkable that these relics of old healthcare policy still exist. In particular, as the FTC, indeed, the FTC in a missive to the state of Virginia, has explicitly called out these CON laws as anti-competitive.
It is really interesting and recalls our conversations with Christy Chapman a few months ago about the history of health policy and how important it is to understand that history.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do think that it's one of the things that's very difficult, I think, for the sort of technocratic rationalizing impulse to get into is the fact that there is just so much, there's so many layers of sediment of past policy, which I hope we can get into in our conversation today. Well, I have something for the lightning round, which is an article about drug shortages in the New York Times. And I know this is a bit of old news. I mean, there are some very interesting articles already out there, like Sharona Hoffman's The Drug Stop Here, which have proposed policy responses. And there have been worries about this for years and a lot of hand-wringing in Congress, but unfortunately not much action. I thought what was really interesting, though, in this week's New York Times article by Sherry Fink on January 29th, was that it described a situation where many doctors were not telling the patients that they were altering the treatment regime because of drug shortages. And there was some waffling in the article about whether these treatment regimens were merely suboptimal or, in fact, were compromising patient health. But the alarm bell that went off in my mind in looking at this piece was potential violations of informed consent, because it just seemed as though many of the patients here who suffered adverse consequences as a result of using the ready-to-hand drug as opposed to the one that was in shortage mode, that they really deserved to understand what was going on. So I just wanted to flag the somewhat submerged legal issue in a widely circulated piece in the Times.
Yes, and as we've chatted, very hard to know exactly what the cause or causes of these shortages are, whether these are benign causes or whether there are boyish pranks afoot that would account for some of this. Well, I found a research letter published in JAMA's Internal Medicine by Dr. Anna Sinai and colleagues, and they looked at high-deductible health plans, noting that the rapid growth of these kinds of plans is driven in part by a belief that cost-sharing obligations, the popular skin-in-the-game model, will encourage health insurance enrollees to shop for healthcare. The research reported here suggests that merely increasing deductibles, which gives enrollees the skin in the game, appears insufficient to motivate or facilitate price shopping. In the cohort they looked at, members with these high deductible health plans and those with traditional plans were equally likely to price shop for medical care and held very similar attitudes about healthcare prices and quality. Now, I don't pretend with this N of one that this study is determinative, but it is always fun to see the behavioral economists occasionally tripped up by data.
Yes, indeed. And so for my final lightning round piece for this week, I just wanted to point listeners to a Politico article on Joe Biden's bid for a cancer moonshot and the divides among cutting-edge scientists that that's causing. Essentially, what's going on is that there's a lot of effort in the moonshot effort to try to get more data sharing on the premise that the more data is shared, the more people will have access to it to make big scientific discoveries. The problems, as pointed out in the article, is that, first of all, you need to create incentives for people to create data. And in some ways, say, regimes of instantaneous data sharing could discourage that, essentially that the less scarce it is, perhaps the less valuable it becomes. The second point made in the article is that essentially, if they were really to become serious about forcing data sharing, that would involve some pretty serious conditions on federal research funding, which do not appear to be in the on the political agenda right now. So some really interesting counterintuitive takes on data sharing. I know that data sharing is often assumed to be a universal good, and also some realism about the plausibility of data sharing without the big stick of conditionality.
Interesting one. So I'll finish with a very brief mention of a new report from the Senate HELP, Help Committee, entitled Preventable Tragedies, Superbugs, and How Ineffective Monitoring of Medical Device Safety Fails Patients. This is actually, if you want to go deep into the weeds, a rather fascinating sort of sentinel event style report on the outbreaks of superbug infections that are now tracked to the endoscopes that are used for those procedures. I recommend the report because it's a really good read, I think, for anyone deeply involved in health safety, because of the way it confirms our picture of multiple failures across multiple stakeholders, including the FDA, but also is a sort of a suggested roadmap forward to avoid such problems in the future. Let me turn and once again formally introduce Devin. I guess we've worked together enough times, and with Frank as well, that this could swiftly degenerate into acronym-laden inside baseball. So I wonder whether you could start us off by explaining what OCR is and what you do there.
Okay, I'd be happy to. So OCR stands for the Office for, not Office of, Civil Rights. And it's part of the Department of Health and Human Services. And it is the office within HHS that is charged with developing policy on privacy and security to implement the HIPAA provisions that require the promulgation of rules on privacy and security and breach notification. And we also then enforce those rules. It's not the only thing that the Office for Civil Rights does within HHS. For example, the office enforces rules against discrimination in the provision of healthcare services that were enacted, for example, as part of the Affordable Care Act or as part of the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example. But my piece of it, the piece that I oversee, deals with HIPAA, privacy, security, and breach notification policy and enforcement.
Well, in January of this year, your office released a new guidance on patient rights and access. And on the OCR blog, Director Samuels introduced this as follows, quote, "Unfortunately, based on recent studies and our own enforcement experience, far too often individuals faced obstacles to accessing their health information, even from entities required to comply with the HIPAA privacy rule. This must change. Can you take us a little deeper into that and what you sort of found when you rolled up your studies and your enforcement data as to these kind of patterns? And then maybe explain a little bit how you think this guidance changes things.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So we are charged with doing a report to Congress on the cases we see with respect to enforcement, the complaints that we're getting with respect, you know, mostly from individuals who have not been able to exercise their rights under the HIPAA privacy rule, one of which is the right to be able to access and get a copy of your health information. And we get a lot of complaints about inability to access that right. And it has consistently been one of the top five categories of complaints that come in our door. And this has not changed. I'm actually fairly new to the Office for Civil Rights. I just joined the office in June, but I was aware of this data when I was an advocate at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And it always was very upsetting to me. You know, the ability of an individual to be able to get a copy of her health information, to be able to access it, to be able to get health information for children or for family members that she may be taking care of is in many ways the essence of patient-centered healthcare. And HIPAA is not that old of a regulation. There are many that are older, but it has been in existence or at least enforceable since 2003. And this right has always been a part of the regulation. And yet people complain a lot about not being able to exercise this right. Complaints as basic as, well, my doctor told me that HIPAA doesn't allow them to give me a copy of my information, which is the exact opposite of what the privacy rule requires, to, you know, sort of more detailed complaints like, I'm being charged exorbitant amounts of money to get a copy of my medical record, or I haven't received a response from my healthcare provider, and it's been more than 30 days. The regulations require a response within a 30-day period, except in certain circumstances. Or they're told that the information that they're requesting is not the information that they are eligible to receive under the HIPAA right. And this is information as basic as, you know, what are the I'd like to see the doctor's notes after my most recent visit. Or I'd like to have a way to get the lab test results myself from the lab. And so we really felt that it was important to be able to clarify this right for individuals to start down a pathway of, again, letting the entities who are covered by the rules, who have to comply with them, to make it much more clear to them what our expectations are beyond what we had previously said in regulatory pronouncements or in guidance that's on our website. And then I think really the next step is starting to enforce this more vigorously than we have in the past. Oftentimes, given the volume of these complaints, we'll just, you know, resolve them by picking up the phone and telling the entity who's required to comply with our rules, you know, you really need to comply with this. You have to give the patient the information she's requested. And typically that's the end of the story. I think that once we've gotten a lot more clarity out there about what we expect, we can begin to bring some enforcement actions to show the covered entity community, HIPAA applies to covered entities, that we're serious about this.
I saw a piece that our friend Jody Daniels, late of ONC, recently did for Bloomberg, and I miserably paraphrase, but she seemed to lay the blame for low levels of patient access at first that some providers just see medical records as assets and don't want to share them. Secondly, requests take time and resources in a very difficult environment, and so they tend to get pushed down in the queue. And third, patients often do not ask for their health information. So I felt that the picture she was kind of painting was one of culture. And I wonder whether this guidance is, in fact, your signal that you're kind of fed up waiting for the culture to change and it's time for it to change now.
I'm very much in agreement with Jody that culture plays a very big role here. I mean, if this were common practice within healthcare institutions, if they recognized that, in fact, it was part of their mission to have patients as partners in their care, to put patients at the center of decision-making, and to provide them with the data on a real-time basis that they would need to make those decisions, which are important. And this may be, in fact, tied to payment reform as well, right? If in fact, outcomes are at least somewhat dependent on what the individual does after they leave the medical office or after they leave the hospital, then putting the information in their hands, information that they can use, becomes a critical part of the equation. If we were in that place in healthcare, frankly, I probably wouldn't have to touch HIPAA because everyone would be performing well above the baseline requirements that are in the privacy rule. But we're not there culturally. And if I can, through guidance on this right of access, start to force that cultural change a little bit, that's a really hard thing to do with regulation. I recognize that. But we do have a set of expectations that we can enforce. And if we can start number one, by making more clear what our expectations are. And number two, by starting to put some muscle behind that right, then hopefully the message will get out to institutions, along with, I think, the other changes that are happening in healthcare that make the patient at the center aspect of it so important. You can't get to that place culturally and starve patients of data, right? They need to have this. There's frankly only so much I can do with the regulations to affect that cultural change. We've gone about as far as we're able to go with the sub-regulatory guidance that we're issuing, and we actually have some more that's coming out soon. But culture change is critical, but we're not going to wait for it. You're right. That's my long-winded answer to say, yes, Nick, you are so right.
That's what I end up saying nearly all the time as well. So I wanted to delve a little bit deeper in the concept of the muscle here behind the guidance. And one of the things that I liked best in the guidance that, again, we'll post up for the show notes is a section that described the intersection between the HIPAA right of access and the HITECH Act's Medicare and Medicaid electronic health record incentive programs view, download, and transmit provisions, also often known as meaningful use or aspects of meaningful use. And I saw that, you know, as part of meaningful use, I forget exactly at which stage, a certain percentage of the eligible provider's patient base has to be able to download the record. And I believe at some point they actually have to prove that a certain percentage did download the record. And I think that can be part of sort of normalizing this idea that individuals should be getting, should be able to have at their fingertips access to their records. But to come back to the question of muscle, do you think either in the case of the EHR incentive program or in the case of the HIPAA privacy rule, there are or will be real monetary penalties for failure to comply? Or do you think that this is the monetary penalties are not going to really be in the offing in this area?
Well, so the meaningful use incentive program, and you're right that the guidance provides exactly the detail that people will need about what the requirements are of that program, the requirements to provide patients with access to data and to have at least a certain number of them take advantage of it, begin in stage two, and then there are additional requirements in stage three. We had the language of this guidance very carefully reviewed by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs the meaningful use program. So it is accurate. Thank God they didn't ask me to do that on my own. I would have gotten it wrong, I'm certain. But the expectations of meaningful use vis-a-vis, you know, getting patients to actually take advantage of the right have changed from what was initially proposed due to some pressure from industry that was very concerned about being measured based on what patients did or did not do. Some of that got walked back a bit. But we have penalties for failure to comply with HIPAA that frankly are can run up into the thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not all the way up into the millions, depending on the nature of the violation and how many records are involved in the violation and for how many days the noncompliance is occurring. And while we have penalized, frankly, only one entity for failure to provide an individual with access to records, and it's actually more than one individual, they were also being penalized for failure to cooperate with us. So the $3.5 million civil monetary penalty was not just about the access issue, but it just, and that's the Signet case for those of you who are familiar with our case record. We have not had very many fines that we have imposed, as I mentioned earlier, on this issue. We need to get there, I think, in order to, if for no other reason, show that we're quite serious about enforcing this right beyond the steps that we take regularly to try to get entities to comply through, you know, those phone calls and technical assistance letters. I think ultimately, if the entities who have to comply with this are really going to dig their heels in, perhaps for those business reasons, Nick, that you mentioned earlier, we may need to help make sure that the financial equation that goes into thinking about whether you're going to give patients information includes the potential for HIPAA penalties. We have them, we've used them, we will use them again.
Talking a little bit more about the interface between meaningful use and HIPAA privacy, one of the ways that patients are going to be able to get hold of their records in this new world is through APIs, the application program interface. Still more listeners turn off at this point. And the questions that the API issue raises seems to me to be particularly delicately poised. Because here you have truly a patient engagement tool as their own software gets attached to the records that potentially really makes it a lot easier for the patients to get control, to exercise control, as so many advocate for PHI. Yet the very method by which they get hold of that data is one that moves data from the HIPAA-protected zone to typically an unprotected zone. And I wondered how you were kind of beginning to work through that, as I say, particularly delicate issue.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's actually hard for us to even think about the kind of guidance we're going to give to our covered entity community with respect to just making the connections to the APIs and taking care of issues like authenticating the machine at the other end of that, or the software at the other end of that API, because it's not, in a technology-enabled world, the patient doesn't present in person and say, you know, please connect to this, you know, piece of software for me and send my records so that you can put a face with the request. You know, it's the right patient asking. You can ideally make the connection into the right record and process that. No, the knock on the provider's door, their record system through APIs is going to be another piece of software. So how do you sort of know that this is in fact has been authorized by the patient who's requesting and that it's the right patient? That I think there are still some gnarly issues to resolve there, but they should be resolvable. And we're talking to folks about what kind of guidance we can provide along those lines. Once the information has been shared by the patient with an app, let's say a mobile app, a health app, that isn't covered by the HIPAA rules because HIPAA's coverage is limited, what does that mean? Well, you know, we have to make sure that our provider community understands that once that they have And this is health plans too, of course. We often think of this as providers and patients, but health plans are subject to this right as well. But once the information has been permissibly delivered to the individual who has the right to receive it, what that individual then does with that information is not the responsibility of the provider. You often hear about providers saying, I'm worried about what the patient's going to subsequently do with it. So making that clear has been part of the goal of our guidance. But then after that, I just don't have the authority under HIPAA to provide some sort of baseline guarantees of privacy and security for that, you know, sort of Internet of Things, mobile app space that we that it's not subject to regulation under HIPAA. The Federal Trade Commission, of course, through its Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Authority, has some authority to oversee privacy and security protections there. But this is a big gap in protections, and it's not one that HHS can fix. It's something that Congress needs to fix.
And I see that we're not exactly running out of time yet, but I have a lot of questions, so I'm going to combine a couple or give you the option to choose which to pursue. One question that I had is, in terms of thinking about, from an insider's perspective, what is most misunderstood about HIPAA, where would future guidances be very helpful? And the second one is, do you think we face more of a privacy problem or a security problem going forward, or both?
Well, I tell you what, Frank, I'll try to be quicker so I can answer both of them. I think we are working on guidance on cloud computing and the use of cloud in healthcare, because there's still a lot of uncertainty about whether and to what extent cloud can be used and when are cloud service options, business associates, and when they're not. That's been a big question. We need to opine on that. And this is really about spurring innovation and not having HIPAA uncertainties be the potential obstacle to innovation. Bringing into healthcare some of the technologies and that are used ubiquitously in other sectors of the economy. So that's I mean, the list of guidance that I want to put out in my tenure, and you know, I'm in a non-political job, so I can stay beyond this next election cycle. But I've got a lot of ideas about where to go next. Second, is it privacy or is it security? I think it is both. I would say if you look at our enforcement cases over the last 2 years, we have definitely been seeing a lot of noncompliance out there on security. That's a big, big issue. Doesn't mean that privacy is, you know, something that we're not paying attention to, and the access right that we just spent a lot of time talking about is a privacy rule issue, but failure to do risk assessments, failure to assess all of the information in the entity's environment, even if they've done a risk assessment, failure to follow up on the findings of that risk assessment, we're just seeing that over and over and over again. In addition to, you know, the stolen laptop problem.
Yes. It is amazing when I think about, you know, how often I see some of these stories. And I think Charlie Ornstein of ProPublica had a piece on repeat offenders and the problem there. One thing I'm wondering about is, do you think that the states also have a role in sort of complementing or tag teaming with the federal enforcers here, and where that might be ideal?
Well, I do think there's a role for states to play, and that is the reason why Congress did not have HIPAA preempt state laws that would be stronger or not conflicting with HIPAA. So there is a role for states to play. Now, that, of course, creates all kinds of dilemmas, I think, for companies that want to be able to operate in all 50 states, much less globally, when there are different regulatory regimes that exist in the different states, and they might be potentially subject to different or laws that are difficult to sort of navigate with one set of policies. So I'm sympathetic to that, but we don't have the resources to be everywhere we would like to be. We never will. So if the states can put some more bodies on the ground and start looking at some of these issues more carefully and provide a backstop, or even be sort of pursuing issues that frankly we cannot pursue because we don't have the authority to do so, I frankly don't see, well, again, I see where the problem is, but I think I think if you have Congress not sort of stepping up and deciding how they want to address this, I think it's perfectly reasonable for the states to step into the void, and many of them have.
Of course, you're probably referring to the high-tech provisions with regard to states' attorneys general being allowed to have some limited enforcement role here. Is there anything you can tell us about how OCR and the states work formally? I mean, is there data exchange on a regular basis and so on?
I wouldn't say that there's exchange on a regular basis. It's typically when we bring an enforcement action against an entity, it's only rarely, at least to date, that the state AG has expressed an interest in pursuing a HIPAA case. They may be pursuing their own state law case, which often allows them to pursue greater penalties than the HIPAA provisions, because as you might remember, the high-tech penalties that the state AGs can pursue are lower than what the federal government can pursue. So they will often proceed along their own state law legal theories rather than pursuing a HIPAA claim. Where they do pursue a HIPAA claim, and where we are also pursuing a HIPAA claim, they are obligated to let us know. And on those occasions, we have tried, we don't pursue joint investigations, but we have tried to stay coordinated in order to not step on each other's toes or be obstacles to each other's investigations. But there's not sort of a formal process. It ends up being much more episodic. I would say I was also, in addition to the state AG provisions that you referred to, you know, a lot of state medical privacy laws, again, the states are being very aggressive in amending them to expand their coverage, California in particular.
And just to our final issue today is there is a lot of excitement and yet trepidation on the Internet of Things as applied to health, perhaps the Internet of Health Things. And I'm wondering if that's on your agenda in terms of thinking about the connected health environment and how, say, some new monitoring systems might interact with that. I was particularly interested, by the way, in your comment on the cloud services as business associates and the sort of complexities that could arise, say, when you have the integration of EHRs, PHRs, personal health records, and cloud providers, and say even app providers and other folks in that ecosystem. Do you think there's ever a chance that there will be sort of a 360-degree view of those things? Or do you think it's going to necessarily be piecemeal, both with respect to devices and with respect to fragmented regulatory authority?
Well, I think the fragmented regulatory authority, well, I certainly hope it's not a permanent condition, is one that I think we're going to have for, you know, potentially some period of time into the near future. Having said that, you know, we've been working very closely with the Federal Trade Commission in talking through guidance that we might be able to potentially issue together, symposia that we, or gatherings that we might be able to co-sponsor. We have a good working relationship with the Consumer Privacy Division. And I'm really hopeful that there are some things that we might be able to do together that while, you know, you still have sort of siloed authorities, we can at least come to the table and try to provide guidance that provides more of a 360-degree view of issues versus just independently going after this and not trying to make a coordinated effort out of it. On top of that, we recently rolled out a portal where we are expressly aiming at the tech developer community and inviting them to provide us with their questions on HIPAA. And in a very ungovernment-like way, we've been actually trying to respond. Typical of government. Yeah, typical of government. We don't do it right away, but we actually have posted a few responses on this portal, and we have some other sort of scenarios on sort of when you trigger business associate status and when you don't that we are finishing up our review of and hope to post very soon. So we're, you know, we're serious about at least trying to clarify our little piece of this world. And hopeful that we can, with, you know, cooperation from our fellow government regulators, FTC, FDA as another example, to be able to achieve that kind of 360-degree clarity that, notwithstanding the silos. I think that's the only way this is going to work, absent action from Congress.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Lore. A special thank you to Devin McGraw for joining us today. It is with considerable avarice that I note her handle on Twitter, where she is at Health Privacy. Frank, how did she get that and not us? I don't know.
Quite impressive.
Yes, indeed.
I grabbed it when I was at CDT.
Yes, you did. Early next month, Devin and I will be on a panel organized by friend of the show, Kirk Nara, at the ABA Emerging Issues in Healthcare Law. And we're going to be talking about wearables and the Internet of Health Things and privacy. That's a conference in San Diego. So maybe we'll see some of you there. It was great fun having you with us, Devin.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
We post our show notes at twirl.com. If you have a moment, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me, not at Health Privacy, but at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. Frank, where can you be reached this week?
I am also on Twitter at HealthPI, which stands for Health Privacy and Innovation.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.